Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. In this episode, obesity medicine specialist and OMA clinical education director Dr. Nicholas Pennings interviews Dr. Lee Ettinger and Michael Osner, highlighted speakers from Obesity Medicine 2020 Virtual, about nutritional interventions to treat obesity. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leader in obesity medicine.
It's been said that all diets work, all diets fail. My main takeaway from that is the common concept of diets has been that they are a quick fix or a short-term solution to what is a chronic problem that is obesity. Diets that focus solely on quick results are doomed to fail because they lack long-term sustainable lifestyle change. The May 2020 OMA virtual conference included lecture series on implementing nutritional strategies. The series included presentations on Mediterranean diet, plant-based diet, and low-carb diet, followed by a panel discussion. The strategies delivered provided long-term approaches with rationales, applications, and resources for incorporating these dietary strategies into your medical practice. Hi, I'm Dr. Nicholas Pennings. I am the Chair of Family Medicine at the Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine and Executive Director of Clinical Education at the Obesity Medicine Association. I have with me today Dr. Michael Osner and Dr. Lee Ettinger. Dr. Osner is a board-certified cardiologist and fellow of the American College of Cardiology. He is the director of wellness and prevention at Baptist Hospital in South Florida. He's an author who's been a passionate voice for prevention in cardiovascular disease. Dr. Ettinger is a pediatric nephrologist at Hackensack University Medical Hospital. He earned his certificate in plant-based nutrition from eCornell and is a diplomate of the American Board of Obesity Medicine and an unabashed vegan. Dr. Osner and Dr. Ettinger were two of the participants in nutritional strategies at the OMA 2020 virtual conference. Dr. Osner spoke on the Mediterranean diet and Dr. Ettinger on plant-based diet. I'd like to thank you both for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having us. It's a real pleasure, and it's an honor to join Dr. Osner again. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So in the discussion of nutritional strategies to treat obesity, the focus is often around how diets are different. But one thing that struck me about this OMA conference was that the different nutritional interventions actually had a lot in common. I'd like to hear from each of you about what you found in common with each of your nutritional interventions compared to the others. Dr. Osner, you spoke of Mediterranean diet. Let's begin with you.
Okay. Well, you know, certainly I think that the Mediterranean diet has a lot in common with both a plant-based diet as well as a low-carb diet, in the sense that, the Mediterranean diet is, in many respects, plant-based, but it also includes fish and other things that I talked about in my lecture. And it basically also contains fat in 25 to 35% of the energy in a Mediterranean diet is fat, but it's mainly in the form of unsaturated and polyunsaturated and monounsaturated fat, as opposed to saturated fat, and certainly no trans fat. So I always like to say that if you really took the best part of a low-carb diet and the best part of a low-fat diet, you'd get a Mediterranean diet. And it's really not an exclusive diet where you're excluding major food groups or macronutrients. And I believe that when I lecture, I often say that the one thing that we do exclude in a Mediterranean diet is highly processed food. And I think that getting away from processed food and getting to foods that are non-processed, that are calorie dense, and that are not calorie dense and that have plenty of nutrients is very important for long-term health as well as weight control.
Well, thank you. Dr. Ettinger, what did you find in common?
Yeah, I think we can all agree that anything is better than the standard American diet, and that these different dietary patterns are more mindful, that you're actually thinking about what you're putting into your body for nutrition rather than grabbing whatever is convenient or whatever is in the closest package to you or the closest store to you. So I like how all the diets just kind of encourage mindfulness and thinking about planning your meals, planning your snacks, and putting into practice what you've learned. I also liked that I didn't hear much about protein from either of the other diets. This is a pet peeve from mine that you probably picked up from my talk, that I think there's just an overemphasis on protein in our culture right now. Every package in the supermarket has how many grams of protein it has. And I feel that's all marketing. And I've gone to obesity conferences where every talk is emphasizing the need for more protein. And I walk away from those conferences and say, like, well, do we have a protein deficiency problem in this country, or do we have an obesity problem in this country? I feel that it's some misguided, misdirected attention on all this need for protein. And then lastly, I just think that we all talked about reducing carbohydrates, the processed carbohydrates in our diet. And the plant-based diet is really strong on complex carbohydrates. And as I described in my talk, if you stop eating processed carbohydrates, you're likely to take 54 pounds of sugar out of your diet every year. And that's bound to help your weight and your blood sugar.
Yes, I found that those were definitely common themes, limiting sugar, limiting those refined processed carbohydrates, and really looking at food based on its nutrient value, I think were very important points. One of the biggest challenges with dietary interventions is maintaining a nutritional program. Patients are frequently faced with hyperpalatable foods and social situations that promote consumption of unhealthy food choices. What do you do to work with your patients to help them stay on your program? Dr. Ettinger, if you'd start.
Well, I really like to try to find their inner motivation as to why they want to make the changes, like their cue to action and what their health belief is about what they're either trying to avoid or what they're trying to gain. And the nice thing about the plant-based diet is that it's gaining in popularity over the past few years, from celebrities to athletes to food documentaries to Instagram influencers. I'm dealing with teenagers, so if I can get the teenager to start talking about what really inspires them and what they like to spend their time doing, then I think I can find an angle. If they like music, there are a lot of musicians right now that are going plant-based. If they like a particular sport, there are a lot of, there's that documentary Game Changers, which talks about how going plant-based can help your athletic performance, or at least not limit your athletic performance. So I really try to figure out what is motivating for the person to help them stick with the diet above and beyond just what they might be trying to do for their own weight or health.
I think those are some great ways of connecting with your patients. Dr. Osner, what do you do to help patients stay on program?
Well, you know, I've always felt that one of the benefits for me with a Mediterranean diet is that it's not very difficult to convince the patient to follow a Mediterranean diet, because, as I said earlier, it's not an exclusive diet. It doesn't eliminate major food groups, and people who are accustomed to eating various types of food, and you sit down with them and tell them you're going to have to be a strict vegetarian or absolutely no carbohydrates, they don't really like that. And if they do go on the diet, usually after several months, they're off the diet. So compliance becomes a big problem. So there's been several large studies that have been published that have shown that of all the diets out there, a Mediterranean diet, as far as compliance, is the easiest diet to follow long term, from the very, very young to the very, very old. And there's no restrictions in it. And so I basically focus the majority of my time, because the food itself is very palatable, and it can be found in any grocery store. And so that makes it easy. I spend most of my time not necessarily trying to convince people to follow a Mediterranean diet, because that's fairly straightforward and easy. I spend most of my time trying to convince my patients not to eat refined starches and sugar, refined carbohydrates, not to eat an excessive amount of red meat and saturated fat and trans fat. And, you know, it basically, that to me is very important, because anytime you institute any dietary plan, it's not so much what you are going to give them, but what are you replacing? And it's very important that people understand what types of foods are good for them, but also what types of foods are bad for them and that they need to avoid. And that's where I have spent most of my time in educating patients. And lastly, I will tell you, is that one of the most important things that people also understand, it's not just diet, because it's lifestyle. And with lifestyle, I always say it's a Mediterranean diet and lifestyle, because it includes daily exercise and activity. And if we're talking about weight control, that becomes very important. You know, I've seen some diets that are very restrictive in calories, but there's no talk about regular exercise. I think that's a very important part of the equation for not only weight control, but also long-term health.
Yeah, so when you're eating plant-based, it can feel very lonely. You might be the only one at the barbecue not enjoying the barbecue, or you might be the only one in your family not eating what everyone else is eating at dinner. So I try to encourage people that, and also when you're feeling, what can I as one person do for animal welfare or for the environment? Does my food choices really impact as much? But I try to encourage people that they're actually joining a movement. And there is change coming, and there is change going on. If you just look at the milk aisle in your supermarket, 10 years ago, there was one dusty soy milk in the corner. Now, in at least in my supermarket, it's like a third plant-based milks and two-thirds dairy milk. And last year, in 2019, two major milk producers, dairy milk producers in the country, went bankrupt because of this changing trend in dairy consumption. So things are changing, and things are going more plant-based, and there are more options. So if you're ever feeling lonely, just know that you're part of a movement.
Well, support is really key for any successful lifestyle change. And it sounds like there's a strong community of support within that plant-based community.
Yeah, patients of mine will get together on Facebook groups or following their, like I said, their favorite celebrities, and there is a sense of community.
So a common question that conference participants had was regarding the use of omega-3 fatty acid supplementation. Patients with elevated triglycerides are at an increased risk for cardiovascular events. A recent study published in the New England Journal examined the addition of a particular omega-3 fatty acid among patients with elevated triglycerides who were also on statins. The risk of ischemic events, including cardiovascular death, was significantly lower among those who received 2 grams of icosapent ethyl twice daily compared to placebo. However, other studies have not shown a benefit. What are your thoughts on omega-3 fatty acid supplements? Should everyone take them? Should they be utilized for individuals with hypertriglyceridemia, or should people just look to dietary sources to increase their omega-3 fatty acid intake? Dr. Osner, let's begin with you.
Okay, well, the study that you're describing was the REDUCE-IT trial. And the REDUCE-IT trial was truly a landmark clinical trial, and it looked at a highly purified EPA ethyl ester. And what we know about EPA as opposed to DHA is that it lowers inflammation, it lowers LDL cholesterol. You know, besides lowering triglycerides, EPA and DHA both lower triglycerides. The problem with DHA is that DHA can significantly elevate LDL cholesterol. And so we've known that. That led to the development of a highly purified EPA ethyl ester. The first major trial was in Japan, the JELIS trial, using also EPA ethyl ester in a population without cardiovascular disease, but who had elevated cholesterol. And they found that this population benefited greatly with a roughly 20% decrease in cardiovascular events by taking essentially a little under 2 grams a day of this product. Now, the REDUCE-IT trial, what makes that very, very exciting is that we haven't had data to date to know what to do with patients when we have their LDL cholesterol. These are high-risk patients in this group. These patients, post-myocardial infarction, for instance, who had their LDL under 70 milligrams per deciliter, but still had residual hypertriglyceridemia, the triglyceride levels above 150 milligrams per deciliter. And we never had any data to say that then lowering that residual hypertriglyceridemia translated into clinical outcome benefit. Now we do. And this was a large, large trial, and it showed a significant 25 to 30% reduction in MACE, that's major adverse cardiovascular events, from heart attack, stroke, cardiovascular death, unstable angina, need for revascularization. So I think that, and it's now FDA approved to do just that, and that's an EPA ethyl ester. There was another trial on the heels of REDUCE-IT called the STRENGTH trial, which was EPA and DHA to see whether or not the addition of DHA would accomplish the same thing in a similar population, and it did not. In fact, the trial was stopped because of futility. So, you know, now knowing this, the question that you actually asked was, what should the average physician do in terms of supplements? And one would have to take three steps back, because it's very important to know that, this product that was used was a pharmaceutical grade EPA ethyl ester that was FDA approved. Unfortunately, when we talk about omega-3 supplements, they are not FDA approved. And there was several large studies throughout the United States, one by Preston Mason at Harvard, where he looked at the most popular omega-3 supplements sold in the United States. And they found that most of these supplements were oxidized. We look at the Totox index, that's the degree of oxidation of the supplements. And you know it when you open up the supplements and it smells fishy, or you have some indigestion or what's called fish burps. You can be assured that that is an oxidized omega-3 supplement, and that is not good for you. Coupled with the fact that in Mason's article, he also showed that the majority of supplements that are sold do not contain what they say they contain on the nutritional label. So if somebody says, gee, I'm going to take a gram of omega-3, you know, it could that gram could be half of that amount. And probably even more contentious is the fact that he found that many of these supplements were loaded with saturated fat. So not only are you getting the omega-3 fat, but you're also getting saturated fat as well. So, you know, the devil is always in the details. And I think that I've always told patients that doesn't mean that you always have to get pharmaceutical grade products. Certainly, we now have a generic fish oil when Lovassa, which was an EPA and DHA product, came generic, and it's now an EPA ethyl ester. You know, so the price has come way down, coupled with the fact that there are organizations like IFAS, the International Fish Oil Standards, where you can actually go there and choose whatever fish oil supplement you happen to get and see whether or not it's, you know, how it's rated. And you want a 5-star rating. You want the one that's top rated. So otherwise, you could be taking something that you might think is anti-atherogenic, and in fact, it's pro-atherogenic. So that's that. Now, I will also tell you that there was another major trial called the VITAL trial. And the VITAL trial looked at the question of, does 1 gram of an omega-3, that's EPA and DHA, in healthy individuals, so now we're talking primary prevention, is it worthwhile? And what they found was interesting. They found that, in fact, there was, if you just teased out in that study, heart attacks, there was a a 28% decrease in heart attacks in those randomized to the EPA and DHAs versus so the placebo. And in addition, in those people that ate less than 1.5 fish meals per week, 1.5 fish meals per week, there was a 40% reduction in the risk of heart attack. And this, then the final thing they noted, which I thought was astounding, was that in African Americans who took the 1 gram of fish oil, a 77% reduction in heart attacks. I thought that was a really fascinating study. And one of the things that highlighted too was that we actually recommend that people take, that people eat fish, and especially cold water omega-3 rich fish, like salmon, like albacore tuna, like sardines. These fish, you know, if you consume at least 2 fish meals per week of omega-3 rich fish, most people will get their omega-3 levels up to where they should be. And one of the things that is important is that I see most clinicians are not doing is measuring an omega-3 level. It's relatively inexpensive, and it's especially the omega-3 index. You could look at the omega-3 index. What we recommend is getting an omega-3 index. Ideally, optimal level is greater than 7%. The typical American is walking around with an omega-3 index of about 3.5%. Now, why is that important? Significant increase in sudden cardiac death for those who have an ischemic event if your omega-3 index is low. So much so that the Harvard School of Public Health did a major trial where they found that if you are in the highest quartile of omega-3 index, namely greater than 7%, you have a 90% less likelihood of sudden cardiac death compared to the people that are in the lowest quartile. A lot of that is due to the effect of the omega-3 on the ventricular fibrillation threshold. It actually raises the threshold so that you're less likely, if you have adequate omega-3 on board, to suffer sudden cardiac death. And there's many, I don't have time to go into the other things that omega-3 does, preventing cholesterol crystals that lead to plaque rupture, decreasing oxidation and especially oxidized LDL, lowering blood pressure, and on and on and on. So I will suffice it to say that, in my opinion, yes, we should consume omega-3. I always start with a natural approach, which is consuming fish. I check levels. If their patient is not adequately at a level that I feel is protecting them, that's when I'll intervene with supplements or generic products. And I feel that the data is strong in that regard. And I'll final statement that I'll make is something that most people don't realize is that low omega-3 deficiency, a low omega-3 level, is one of the top 10 preventable causes of death in the United States.
All right. Well, thank you. Dr. Ettinger, anything you want to add to that or maybe discuss omega-3 sources for plant-based
diet? Yeah, so actually, fish do not make fish oil. Omega-3s are made by sea algae. And the tiny fish eat the sea algae, and it goes up the food chain and gets concentrated in the large fish like the salmon and the tuna. Unfortunately, there's no market for sea algae, but there is a market for fish and for fish oil supplements. And so that's my unabashed vegan opinion. But I'd also like to add that I don't know if there's necessarily any benefit to fish oil or omega-3 itself. What benefits is the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3. So the if you picture omega-6 on top and omega-3 on the bottom, there's the considered the healthiest ratio is a 4-to-1 ratio. However, the typical American is eating a 15-to-1 or up to 30-to-1 because they're getting a lot of omega-6s in all the animal products and especially the red meats. So when you all these studies that actually encourage fish eating are actually just improving the ratio by decreasing the number on top, the omega-6, and increasing the number on the bottom, hopefully bringing that 15-to-1 ratio back down to 4-to-1. And I think that's where you're getting the benefits. I improved my ratio not by eating fish, not by improving the denominator, but by eliminating the numerator. So by not eating the animal products, I hope that I'm getting down to the 4-to-1 ratio. And then I sprinkle some chia seeds or some hemp hearts in my smoothies or on my oatmeal in the morning, and that gives me a little boost of omega-3s also, and I don't worry about it. So really improving that ratio is the goal, and that's what I try to do with the plant-based diet.
Yeah, I think the ratio is important, like Dr. Ettinger said. I will tell you that the that EPA itself, independent of the ratio, has been shown in clinical trials published in peer-reviewed journals like the New England Journal of Medicine that the EPA actually helps to reduce atherosclerotic plaque formation. It helps with plaque regression. It helps to improve endothelial function, and in so doing, increases nitric oxide, which lowers blood pressure. EPA lowers inflammation, which is very important. You know, we also know that EPA itself decreases oxidative stress. And what we really understand with oxidative stress is that that is extremely important when these atherogenic lipoproteins get trapped in the arterial wall. It's when they get oxidized that the macrophages come in and gobble them up, and we're off to the races for atherosclerotic plaque formation and a whole host of other things. So while I totally agree with Dr. Ettinger and what he said, and I just think that EPA by itself, assuming nothing else, EPA by itself has been shown to do all those beneficial things, and all of that became a clinical reality when the REDUCE-IT trial was published, because we see the net impact, and the thing that really everybody cares about the most is, okay, that's great, but what can you do to reduce my risk of dropping dead from a heart attack, a stroke, of a cardiovascular event? So, you know, I think that, you know, we have to be smart. I think that, you know, what Dr. Ettinger and I fully agree with that. Decreasing, you know, a lot of the meat consumption that we are doing in the United States, and improving the ratio. But I still feel that what we have now is something that we can help to reduce the leading cause of death and disability in the United States, that being cardiovascular disease.
All right. Well, thank you. There's a lot more we could talk about, but unfortunately we're out of time. So I want to end with just one last thing. What is your favorite bit of advice to healthcare providers who treat patients with obesity? Dr. Ettinger, let's begin with you.
Well, according to the Journal of American Medical Association in 2010, they had a report that dietary choices were the number one cause of morbidity and mortality in this country. So I think it behooves doctors to be addressing this number one cause of morbidity and mortality. So another benefit that you get from talking about nutrition with patients is a thank you. You know, I've never gotten a thank you from a family for starting an antihypertensive medicine. But all the time I get a thank you from patients who have taken my nutrition advice and been able to either come off of their antihypertensive medicine or not even need to start their antihypertensive medicine. So that's why we all got into this, is to help the patients. And I do appreciate the thank yous. And if you go down this path, hopefully you'll be getting plenty of thank yous like that.
Yes, I experienced that too in obesity medicine. I think patient gratitude is one of the things that makes it very enjoyable. Dr. Osner.
Yeah, so, you know, I basically would sum it up by saying if we, you know, what we're looking at is certainly in the patient who walks into the office who's overweight or obese, is what can we do in order to get them to lose weight in a healthy way? And I have found that, you know, emphasizing a eating pattern that we didn't talk about fiber today, but fiber-rich food is very important. you know, for where do we find fiber and fruits and vegetables and whole grains. And if we, I tell my patients, you know, they certainly, I like to see them consuming an adequate amount of fiber. What's that? Greater than 35 grams a day for a man, greater than 25 grams a day for a woman. You can get that by eating a Mediterranean diet, which is really rich in fiber. And if you look at processed food, what is processed food? It's fiberless food. So fiber helps with satiety, and it's certainly study after study have shown that it helps in weight control and in health. So that is one of the key elements. And also, I look at the scientific scrutiny of weight control. Because, you know, the if you look at the study that were published in the major journals, including, again, the New England Journal of Medicine with Shea and her colleagues, which compared Mediterranean diet to low-fat, low-carb diets, the Mediterranean diet at 2 years was the one of the leading diets for that. So we know it works. We know it works in comparison to other diets. The main advantage to me, it's a win-win, because if we can get somebody who is overweight or obese and get them to shed some pounds with a healthy eating pattern along with regular exercise, and we can also at the same time achieve better health, lowering blood pressure, lowering lipids, lowering lipoproteins, lowering inflammation, lowering oxidative stress. That is a win-win in my opinion. And I think that's really, I've been in the trenches of prevention for more than 3 decades. And I think that that's really what everybody's after. Yes, ideal weight control is important, but also get your ideal weight control along with achieving good health. And to me, that's the name of the game, to live a long, happy and heart healthy life.
And certainly a plant-based diet is very high in fiber and also successful for weight loss and healthy parameters. So we end where we begin, looking at what we have in common and what we're both able to achieve with different nutritional interventions. I'd like to thank you both for participating in the podcast today and look forward to seeing you again at future conferences.
Thank you, Dr. Pennings, Ettinger, and Osner. For more information about Obesity Medicine Podcast and other resources from the clinical leader in obesity medicine, please visit obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. Love this episode of Obesity, a Disease? Head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. The views expressed in this podcast episode are those of the show host and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please check back soon for another episode of Obesity, a Disease.